Okay, so here's an idea. We shape places, and places shape us. Let me try to say it a different way. The places that we build together can either open up possibilities and ways of interacting, or it can shut them down. And there are people that actually do that for a living. So they go to work every day, and that's the thing that they think about. So today on the show, I talk to one of those people. What's happening? I'm Blaine Lay, and you're listening to Two People. It's a podcast about Richmond. In each episode, we talk to someone from around town about their personal story and how it comes to life and the work they do. Today on the show, I sit down with Bert Pennick. He's an architect at Baskerville, and Bert's helped to design some places in Richmond that are really unique to where we live. So the Black History Museum, the Richmond Slave Trail, and he's also currently working on the design for the 17th Street Farmers Market down in Shaco Bottom. I should also mention that he's helping to shape the citywide master plan on the Advisory Committee for Richmond 300. So if urban design is your jam, then you've come to the right place. But we don't just talk city stuff. Bert grew up as the son of a Jamaican immigrant in Tuskegee, Alabama. So he reflects on his upbringing, how he got interested in design and architecture, and he shares his perspective on what design can do in the life of a community. We recorded this episode at Bert's office, so at the end, you know, it's possible that we may do a bit of walking around. This is episode 36 with Bert Pennick. You're listening to Two People. Good. Thanks for being on the show. We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thanks for making the time. I know you have things going on in your world, so we appreciate you being with us.
This is fun.
I wanted to start by asking you about your upbringing. So you grew up in Tuskegee, Alabama.
Yeah.
In the 60s and 70s. So as you think about your hometown, your family, can you just paint a picture of what it was like growing up in Tuskegee in the 60s and 70s?
Sure. You know, Tuskegee, like probably any small town USA, is very isolated. At the time, it was less than 9,000 people, maybe. And, you know, I went to one of two elementary schools. One was all black. One was not. Mm-hmm. and 99% of the population was African American. And, yeah, it was just, you know, and it was, you know, the time when you came home from school, and then your mother said, get out. And then after the sun came down, you start yelling, come home. So it was great. And I mean, as far as my world leading up to architecture, and I only came to know this probably much later in life, but I had the great fortune of being exposed to Tuskegee Institute, it was called at the time. Mm-hmm. Where Booker T. Washington did his work, and it's famous for all a number of things.
Tuskegee, but also Airmen, and George Washington Carver.
George Washington Carver, mm-hmm. You got it. And Robin Roberts, who's famous for saying "Bye, Felicia," mm-hmm. to Omarosa.
She's famous for other things as well. But yeah.
No. That's it. Right now, that's it. That is cast in stone. So yeah, you know, it's a famous little place.
And your father worked there?
Yeah, my father, who's from Jamaica originally,
okay,
came to Tuskegee to do his postdoc work. That's where he met my mom, and that's, you know, where they had five kids.
Your mother, was she American?
She, okay. Yes. My mom's born and raised in Alabama as well.
Do you have a sense, I mean, you talk about your elementary schools, where you went to the African American one, there was a white school, and your father worked at Tuskegee.
Yeah.
He's not an American national by birth. Do you have a sense of just what his perspective was like as someone that came from Jamaica to the U.S. and just his sense of how race played in Alabama in the 60s and 70s?
I mean, his work, my dad's life's work, was about raising the status of particularly the African-American farmer, mm-hmm. in rural Alabama, rural Georgia. And he came from an agricultural background in his life in Jamaica. And what he saw was that there was a great disparity in the terms of the quality of life, mm-hmm. of what was around him.
Right.
And so he went on to raise millions of dollars for a very small institute, African American Institute, HBCU, Tuskegee, to accomplish that work. He created what was called a Human Resources Development Center, money from Kellogg, money from all kinds of foundations across the world. And, you know, we were kids, and all we know is Dad went to work.
Right.
And he would go travel, you know.
And you just got to be home for dinner.
You just got to be home for dinner. Yeah. You know, and he traveled to, you know, Africa and China and Russia and all over the world, just sort of raising money, raising awareness, and trying to raise the status.
Yeah.
That was his work.
And how did you get into architecture? I mean, was that something that, did you have that knack as a young kid, or was that something that came along later?
I mean, I guess my mom would tell you I was artistic as a young kid, but, and mothers say all their children are artistic, maybe, I don't know. But what was fascinating to me were certainly buildings, and I sketched little houses kind of thing, and
right.
liked looking at the magazines of, you know, Better Home house plans and right. stuff like that. And I had the great fortune of playing around the university campus. Like, you know, like in the summer, mom goes to work, she takes all the kids to work, and then kids go play, I'll be done in five. And we had this chapel on the campus of Tuskegee Institute that was designed by Paul Rudolph, who was an internationally known architect at the time. It was this soaring brick modern thing on a campus of very historic buildings. And we found it fascinating. And the chaplain there was great. He would let us play and run around, whatever we wanted to do, because it had winding stairs and,
right.
and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, this is cool. This is really cool. For whatever reason, physical space
yeah.
like that was fascinating.
Sounds like the physical space created a place for you to play as a kid.
It was great, and I just you know and as far as I can remember, that's kind of all I wanted to do. I think I remember thinking, all right, if I had to, I could be some kind of graphic designer or illustrator or something, but that sounds sort of second rate.
No offense, designers. No, it's an important skill to have.
It is.
But yeah,
it is.
Not
it
for
is.
You.
It is. So that you know, and that just that has just been what I've always planned to do.
Yeah. So you got your degree from Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
In architecture.
Yeah.
And your family moved to Virginia?
Yeah. When my older brothers had gone off to college, and it was just me and my sister, and my dad took a position at Virginia Tech in agricultural economics. And I just came home one day and said, we're moving to Virginia. It's like, where's that? Yeah, so I was still in high school. My sister's in elementary school, so I did a couple of years in high school in Blacksburg. And when I got ready to go to college, my counselor was like, well, Virginia Tech's ranked number 5 in the country, and it costs like $3 a quarter to go there. It's like, okay then.
We can make that work. Let me just run some quick numbers.
And my dad was like, hey, you can get a job, and you can pay for your own college.
All right. All right, Dad.
I'm on it.
It took you a while to complete your degree. So okay, correct me if this is right, but you started in 82. You ended in 92. I mean, to me, that's a remarkable decade. And it sounds like some of it was based on their philosophy of education. But you worked in the forestry service for a little while. You went to New York. You went to Europe.
I still think Tech has one of the best programs around, and just the way they think about it. And it sort of let me do things on my own pace.
Right.
So after my second year, third year, I had a colleague who was also my year who was Italian and came back home after being in Rome for the summer, or at home for him. And said the firm that he worked for was kind of looking for somebody. And I was like, well, that sounds cool. And I said, I'll go. And so that just sort of started a sort of trek doing experiences outside the norm.
Yeah, and how did getting out of the country shape your perspective during that formative time?
Well, that's a great
question. Or did it? I don't want to assume.
No, that's a great question because, I mean, I would say that if somebody has made that transformation and didn't shape their ideas about things. That would be strange. I remember that the world just seemed more tightly knit than I'd experienced it before, right? There was a sense of understanding of history and place and all of that just sort of ingrained in everybody I ever met, you know, at all different levels, right? You know, sort of there seemed to be sort of that pride and heritage and all that. And what struck me at the time was being African American, having a history that is nebulous in terms of understanding exactly what it is, kind of came into focus. And that's began to really sort of shape how I thought about things. Also, just in the one of my favorite architects overseas was his name Luigi Snazzi, and the sphere of his practice was about three villages in southern Switzerland, and that's where he did all his work. Internationally known guy, but his focus was baked into where he lived and grew up and practiced, and it was all about sort of that kind of commitment to his community. And I, you know, until then, you know, in school we'd studied sort of the great masters of the world, kind of Frank Lloyd Wrights and Louis Kahns and Mies van der Rohe and that kind of world, and this was different. This was a different approach.
Yeah, it sounds like it's perhaps the same level of skill, but really focused on a geography and like
it's focused on a geography, but it draws from an innate understanding of a place, right? And it's something that's probably difficult to be able to translate from Kansas to California to Maine to Canada to Mexico in the same way. And that was, again, it was impressive. And so I kept sort of, you know, I did just bouncing around for 3 years because I sort of worked on the other end of the spectrum for a different architect that was sort of practicing across the planet and doing very fascinating things. But it was the other that I found.
Yeah, and it seems like you were developing and have this like conviction about what design can do, right? So the way that a sense of place and creating that and what that can do for the life of a community. And I wonder, I mean, we look at our city, historically it's often been marked by a division in a lot of ways when we think about race and class and even geography. On the website for at Baskerville, it says that you have this quote, you have a conviction that architecture can provide solutions to cultural challenges. How do you see design fitting in the mix as we work towards addressing some of these issues and building like the fuller community that we aspire to be?
Yeah. Well, first I have to tell you my beliefs about architecture are pretty grand in terms of what it is. Because what I say to, like, when I get a chance to talk to students first, just think back. When doctors were using leeches and lawyers were burning people at the stake, architects were designing cathedrals. And that sort of sums up sort of what I think the power of our profession has been always. And so the built environment, the room that we're sitting in, the table we're working at, the spaces that we do are all things that someone has conceived of in some way to be built, and that is architecture. So our environment is all driven by the quote-unquote architecture that we create. So the human experience, the human condition, in that sense, is touched by architecture every day, every minute. When we think of, you know, the idea of designing cathedrals, we have to think of it in terms of doing it for everybody that's part of a community. The egalitarian approach to architecture is a challenge in a capitalist society, undoubtedly.
Right.
but I do have the belief that it is required to serve the least of us.
Yeah.
That's a fight,
yeah.
Right? But it has to be approached that way. Otherwise, we're relegated to doing the 1% of
And I think you kind of alluded to it, but the market doesn't necessarily reward that. We obviously need like commercial and residential, but how do we also develop places and spaces for everyone? And I think there's a beauty in what I sense is how you've approached your portfolio of work, where you got to keep food on the table, but we can also do some really meaningful work. And it doesn't have to be either or, but that it can be both and.
And that idea led to the sort of founding of our nonprofit design center here in Richmond. So not quite a decade ago or so, a lot of like-minded people had already been trying to figure out how to do this, how to bring design and design services to everyone in the city.
And you're talking about storefront for community design.
I'm talking about storefront for community design, yeah. You know, in this city that has 4,000 or so public housing units, you know, majority of which live in the East End of Richmond. And so the idea that we can tap into people who want, who believe as we do, that this is something that should serve our whole community, and create a nonprofit design center to provide those services. The dynamics that we work with in the city are shifting in the right way. We have touched on new regulatory issues, new zoning issues that will start to look at providing proper housing, affordable housing, equitable housing, equitable opportunities in business. And
yeah, I mean, it sounds like, I mean, you served on any number of boards and commissions. You know, I think you have a sense, obviously, of the aesthetics, but even just the wonkery of how zoning and land use.
Yeah.
Do you see, like, barriers, like structural barriers to an approach to design? Is that what you're saying when you're saying there's this shift that's happening?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so, for example, now as a developer, there's financial incentive to provide affordable housing in your housing project.
Got it.
You know, whereas it was sort of a altruistic sort of thing to do before, where now the city is, like other localities, is figuring out how to say to you, developer, okay, you want to do 100 units. If you do 10% with 60% median income, you give it a break on tax credits or something to that effect,
right?
That's a good thing.
Yeah. So to say it back to you, we can say, hey, this is what we value, housing for everybody. Let's build in the structures that actually make that possible.
Yes.
So that you provide some incentive for folks.
And so it's an ongoing process. We get better at it. Got a long way to go still. Yeah.
It's a process, right?
It's a process.
So you're now at Baskerville. You started here. You had your own shop for 15 years.
Yeah.
You're back here. You obviously do some of the straightforward projects like residential, commercial, but you also work on some of these projects that are really unique to Richmond when we think about the Black History Museum, the Slave Trail. Do you mind just sharing a bit about your work in those spaces, either on the Black History Museum or the Slave Trail, and just how those bodies of work impacted you personally?
Sure. I mean, the Slave Trail work, which I've been working with the commission in the city in that area for over 10 years, almost going on 15 years now, I guess. And I remember sort of back in the day when I was first at Baskerville and they hung up the banners on the flood wall, and there was one of Robert E. Lee hanging there just outside our office, and somebody had torched it. And I came out of the office that day, and I was fairly new to Richmond still, and a reporter or something caught me on the street and said, you know, what do you think about this? And I didn't have an apartment yet. You know, I was like making like $3 an hour.
I'm just trying to figure out what I'm going to eat.
Exactly.
What's for dinner?
This is what I'm saying. So, but that sort of, you know, to explain my sort of ignorance about the history of Richmond. But that I changed that. And then sort of getting engaged with the Richmond Slave Trail Commission was certainly eye-opening. And I've continue to learn more and more and more about the role that this city and this region played in the history of that institution. And going back to the idea that design is equitable,
mm-hmm.
not only for economic purposes, but also for cultural purposes. And so trying to find the equity in the cultural history of Richmond has become and remains a focus.
Mm.
Working to bring the slave trail story to light has been very important. And so that led to other aspects of the history, working with the Black History Museum, working with the American Civil War Museum, working with other groups in that sphere. And so that work is not traditionally just architecture, but it touches on all kinds of aspects of design.
Yeah.
I fancy myself a landscape designer time to time, but I'm not. I just slept in the Holiday
Not stepping on anybody's toes. What if we put some bushes here? I don't want to do your job.
The famous architecture lot. Shrub it up, man. Just
What if we put in some streetscaping and just some...
Exactly. You know, but it's just sort of thinking it in big terms of, like, you know, what is really design and planning.
Yeah, and I think you're speaking to, I think the question of what makes a city healthy. I think often it's easy to go very quickly to just the economics of things. Like, hey, are we making money?
Yeah.
How's the tax base? Which is important, and you have to have that. But I think when we think about equity and even just the built environment, is it a beautiful place? Is it a place where people can sort of grow and thrive? Can everyone do that? That I think it gets a little more interesting, because sometimes, occasionally, those things can be in tension. And so how do we figure out, like, what are our values? Where do we want to go as a city and a region? And how do we then design towards that? Whether you're an architect or you worked in the public sector, private sector, that we all have a role in doing that. I want to ask about 17th Street Marketplace.
Sure.
This is what I'm probably most excited about, because I drive through there occasionally, and I'm like, oh, man, it's just a big concrete hole right now. But you've done work, I mean, obviously, on the Slave Trail Commission. I think you were involved. A few years ago, there was discussion of putting a baseball stadium in that space.
Yeah.
That is no longer happening.
Yeah.
What's the latest on, like, how are you thinking about that from a design standpoint, and what's your hope for the 17th Street Marketplace?
Well, my hope for the 17th Street Marketplace is it just becomes a functional public space that everybody can use when they want, how they want. To put it simply, that is the great hope. And it's taken us years to sort of get to that party and sort of doing workshops and engagements, talking to people, all that kind of thing.
Is it only going to be walkable? Would you be able to drive through or no?
It will be drivable, because we have to be able to service businesses that are along the market. So it'll be I just made up a word. There will be bollards that
bollards?
Block it off.
Okay.
But on the day-to-day operations, it's just a walking space.
Okay.
It's a pedestrian-only kind of space.
Can I have a farmer's market there?
Yes,
or absolutely. like a stage with a band?
Yes.
And, like, different events?
Yes.
Like, can I sit there and enjoy my time with my wife and my kid?
Yes.
All right.
And yes.
I can walk around that healthy. Can I take public transportation there?
Soon.
Sort of. Yeah, it's coming. Not right now, but in the future.
Yes. Yes. All right. So,
can I spend money at those restaurants there?
I hope so.
Okay.
It's. I mean, I won't lie to you. It's been a hard slog for those guys. It's get it done. But there will be a much better environment. I will say, you know, we get a lot of flack for all the stuff that's happening in Richmond and how it's affecting business.
Yep.
But I'll tell you, it's sort of the improving of our city is great to see. And, you know, not to be cliche about it, but growth is painful.
Mm-hmm.
It is. And hopefully we'll be better for it on the other side. And 17th Street included in that. But, you know, I will say this about that project. It was more – are you going to bleep this? It was more about not fucking it up. I'm just going to – than anything else. It's like –
podcast, man, you can say
it. Yeah. And really, that it's hard as designers to not to want to sort of do all kinds of things in blank space. Mm-hmm. But it was about just don't mess it up.
Yeah.
Keep it simple.
I want to ask you about Richmond 300, mm-hmm. which is the shaping of the downtown master plan. So you're the vice co-chair of the advisory committee.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right.
Could you just explain to folks what the purpose of the master plan is, why it's important, why we need to have it?
Sure. I mean, so first of all, localities, cities are required in the state code to provide a master plan. And it can be as simple as two planners sitting down and saying, this is what we're going to do for the next 20 years,
right,
and submit it and be done. Richmond, for the first time in recent history, has a good clip at growing. You know, it is literally the population is increasing, mm-hmm. and it's becoming that destination. You know, my God, just the top 10, whatever.
People are voting by U-Hauls coming in.
Just exactly. And having a plan for growth is applicable to anything you do, and especially sort of city like this. And then when we talk about a city that has the kinds of disparities that we have and its cultural and economic communities, finding the way to at least think about what it's going to look like so that we can bring those disparities closer together,
yeah,
is critical. And being able to do it with the participation and the input of the people that are directly affected is hypercritical.
Right.
It's hard, and it's ugly,
yep,
as is everything. But I don't think we should do it any other way.
So it shouldn't be two designers in a room, is what
it should
saying.
Not be two designers in a room saying this is what we're going to look like in 30 years.
Yeah. How do you do that practically? Because I think that there are a lot of instances in our city and our region where public input is needed. But do you have any, I don't know, rules from the road on here are some ways that we can actually get that public input that we need from folks that's, I think, both helpful and involves everyone in the conversation? It just seems like it's hard to do that well.
It's hard to do it well, and it's hard to do it quickly. And certainly at this scale, it can't be done quickly. My experience has been sort of, you know, like with some of the things, is to try and break it down. You know, eat an elephant one bite at a time.
Right.
And getting people into a space without an agenda is first and foremost. And then letting the input be what it's going to be and let people say what they want to say and do what they need to do, and then figuring out the actionable pieces of that. Not everybody's going to get what they want to get or that kind of thing, but being able to address it as to why or why not,
right,
and take the actions afterwards, I think it's as simple as that. So I think the successful participation and input is only measured by the outcomes and actions that happen.
Sure. And I think that the perception of, I'm going to use a big word, but like the legitimacy, mm-hmm, of the process, that,
yeah,
I think often people just want their voices to be heard, to say, hey, here's all the things that I think. I just want you to hear me first and,
yeah,
then figure out like, okay, what are we going to do? That I think if someone is heard, then they're more open to what the eventual output is.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And Ryan Wren is our executive director, mm-hmm, at Storefront, and he and his team, I think, have evolved the process of community input,
yeah,
in such a way that is as non-contentious as it can be. And the process is, okay, I'm not going to provide a platform for you to get up behind a mic and lecture everybody in the room, but I will give you a platform to say whatever you need to say, write whatever you need to write, give the kind of input you want to give, like that. Because we have become that place where sometimes public meetings become just a forum for,
right,
me to yell at you.
Right.
And that's not productive.
And I think it's easy for
regardless of the issue, for both sides to dig their heels in deeper.
Yes.
It's like, here's a microphone. Yeah. Everybody line up.
Yeah, exactly.
And begin with the yelling and the fist banging.
And so we just have to get past that point.
This is a little bit of a wonky question, but how does BRT and the transit changes that are happening change the way that we think about downtown? I mean, you're basically, BRT will be the spine.
Yeah.
And then we're going to redraw basically the city bus lines to as like the ribs that link up to the spine.
Yeah.
Does that impact the way that you think about the plan?
No, I mean, I'm going to say it probably expands, and I'm going to try and connect some dots here, you know, sort of talking about my history of working in other places and other countries and experiencing other things and seeing sort of how those places evolve. And Mark Olinger, our director of planning, I really love the fact he's almost every meeting he starts with, I want you to know one thing. We have 62.5 square miles in the city of Richmond.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. From now until, barring some catastrophic event, that's it. So how do we grow that within that space? It means we're going to be denser. We're going to be more tight. And that's perfectly fair. And so figuring out the systems and infrastructure that work within that.
Right.
I mean, that's sort of the BRT. So it's a component that has always been needed.
Yeah.
It's just figuring out how to do it in the proper way. And then you start putting zoning around it saying, okay, I love this little one-story thing we've been doing for a while, but we need more people.
Right.
We need more spaces for people, and we need to do the spaces in an equitable way. Mm-hmm. It's all tied together, right?
Right.
You and I will be dust.
Right. Long gone. Yeah, my wife and I live in the city, and they've built a couple houses on our street, and it's, you know, dense, walkable, whatever. And sometimes we're like, oh, man, we can't park right in front of our house anymore. Kind of like, well, I don't know if that's what we're signing up for. If, like, to your point, it's like we have 62.5 square miles. If we're building dense, like, A, you might not have a car in the future, and exactly. B, you're not going to be able to just roll up and just be like, all right, here I go, take my groceries out. So I think it requires a different way of living.
And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, now we have the conversations going about sort of what does artificial intelligence look like and all that, and sort of automated systems and, you know, driverless cars and the whole nine yards. But we're having real conversations about, for example, how we're designing parking decks, you know. So the idea that make sure you're designing parking decks that are flexible in the future, so the little 7 foot high sloped floor kind of thing that's not going to get it because you can't convert that to something else. Design parking decks so they can become future offices or housing, or because at a certain point the car is going to become less.
So what does that mean? Do you build it? Do you use no steel and it's like a bamboo situation, like a hut?
No, it means it's sort of, you know, you're sort of thinking about it as a. Think about the superstructure, right, of an office building, which is just flat floors and straight columns, kind of thing. So you're just thinking of it in that way.
That's interesting.
Kind of thing. You know, we were having lunch with some folks the other day, talking about sort of, I have a client who says, I have to drive. I need to drive, you know. And the other sitting across the table going, I don't drive anywhere. I just, you know, Lyft, Uber, you know, take the bus, whatever. And so the whole need for you to be able to necessarily park right in front of your house might be going the way of the dodo bird.
So this is my final closing question for you, Bert Pennock. So at a really high level, I mean, we were talking about this idea of design, right?
And yeah.
I think there are a lot of people that are working in Richmond that are trying to create the Richmond of tomorrow. Yeah. And I'm speaking about, like, really broadly, from public officials, teachers, mm-hmm. you know, folks in the private sector, large institutions here in town. As you think about shaping this place where everyone can thrive, what do you feel like we need to do less of, and what do you feel like we need to do more of? And you could take a moment if you need to.
Yeah.
just a softball.
Wow. Wow.
You can noodle on it. If it's helpful and we want to, like, walk around and you want to come back to that one, we could do that.
Let's do that.
So that's what we did. I grabbed the mic, and Bert gave us a small tour of his office. So Baskerville, as I mentioned, is in Chaco Bottom in a big refurbished warehouse. And he walked us through as his coworkers were cranking away. We walked by the materials library, where they've got samples of carpets and tiles and woods and all the stones that they use for inspiration as they design things. And then we walk up to Bert's workspace, and he sits under this big skylight. He's got multiple computer monitors there, big drafting board with a light, a shelf of design books. And pretty quickly, he brought up something that I didn't notice at first glance.
I have a Confederate flag and an American flag on my desk. And from time to time, somebody will come by and remove the Confederate flag and sort of stick it under, like, the chair or something. I don't know why, and no one has spoken to me about it, but I hope that it would let people sort of ask why. Because there's the truth of the history, and then there's where we are today.
Can I ask why?
Yeah.
Why do you keep it up there, and why do you have both?
Because it is just that. It is a part of the history of who we are, and there is really a way to interpret it and talk about it without having to relive it. So one of the things I think I sort of realize also in my travels and living with this, we're fairly young as a country, and we're, you know, in the spectrum. If the Chinese are our grandparents and the Europeans are our parents, we're like the third youngest kid in the family running around. So we are still too close to that kind of history to see it objectively, but it is there. We should talk about it. Man, going back to your question, what should we do less of? We should do less silos. Less silos. And we should do more of just that, being able to sit down and figure this stuff out.
Yeah, what are some of, like, the silos that you see when you think about that?
Well, I mean, the obvious one is just black and white. Those are silos that we still live in, particularly in this area of the country and in this city, that rich and poor, it's big side. Those baked in inherent silos are not givens. They are not. And the more we work to get past them, the better off we'll be. The haves and have nots, those are the dumb ones. In this office, the architects and the interior designers, two different silos. But
yeah, there's a question of degree.
There's a question of degree.
And I think you're right that it doesn't have to be that way, unfortunately, in Richmond. And I think the haves and the have-nots and race is unfortunately tied here.
It is. But, you know, we'll get there.
And before we wrapped, I was observing how unique it is that Baskerville has a part of their company dedicated to projects specifically for Richmond. The idea that you have, like, a community studio inside of the firm, I wonder if what would it look like if other private companies in town had something like that? I don't know what my question is, but I'm just thinking out loud about.
Yeah. So the broader definition of what community is when you look it up in Webster's, right? I think it's how you have to sort of think about it and all that entails. So all the parts and pieces that make up a whole are pretty distinct, and they all contribute to that whole. So, I don't know how that could apply across the board, but it's all about working with, I guess, right where you are with right what you have.
For more on the Richmond Master Plan, check out richmond300.com. Check out Storefront for community design. Ryan Wren and his team do great work, and he's also got one of the best beards in Richmond. Special thanks to Lauren Licklater at Baskerville for helping with the logistics. As always, you can subscribe to the show via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme is by No BS Brass. Chris Payne, our producer, is a fresh-cut lawn. And thanks to Ben Tease for his production help on this one. He's the guy that you heard in the background there say, "It's a podcast. You can say whatever you want." Thanks for listening.